From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, we look at President Trump's visit to Kenosha, what happened and what didn't. Then a local journalist gives her thoughts on how to move forward in Kenosha following protests for racial justice.
The problem is that the infrastructure hasn't responded. People may be responding to it, but the infrastructure and the policies has been very stagnant.
Plus, the recent protests over racial justice have raised a lot of questions about racism for kids. A local therapist says parents shouldn't shy away from them.
We are still learning how to talk about race as adults, even to this day. So it's okay if you don't have all those answers with your kids, but just knowing that the earlier the better with the conversation is best.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. Kenosha remained in the global spotlight yesterday as President Donald Trump visited the area 9 days after Jacob Blake, a black man, was shot by a white Kenosha police officer. The shooting led to protests. Buildings were razed by demonstrators, and protesters were tear-gassed by police. Kenosha has also been reeling after 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse shot and killed two people and injured a third. Rittenhouse was part of a heavily armed counter-protest group that claimed to be protecting businesses. The president came to the area Tuesday despite the wishes of state Democratic leadership like Governor Tony Evers and the mayor of Kenosha, who expressed fear that Trump would fan flames of division. WUWM's Mayan Silver reports on the president's visit. Hi, Mayan.
Hi, Joy.
So Trump was here to tour property damage and meet with law enforcement. Can you tell us how that visit unfolded?
Sure. Trump stepped off Air Force One in Waukegan, Illinois, with Attorney General William Barr and Wisconsin Congressman Brian Steil. He was greeted by a masked U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Trump did a tour of Kenosha, including an emergency management center and its damage downtown. He then sat for a roundtable with law enforcement, including Kenosha County Sheriff David Beth and City of Kenosha Police Chief Daniel Miskinis. Several local business people and state and federal Republican leadership were also there, and the roundtable lasted about an hour.
So what was the president's main message as he was meeting with both law enforcement and these elected officials?
It was the law and order message that the president has been touting since the George Floyd protests. It was thanking police officers. It was deriding the radical left and Antifa. It was blaming Democratic leadership for the unrest. It was taking credit for the National Guard settling in Kenosha. That's actually something that Governor Evers did. Evers ordered the Guard in on Monday morning as soon as Kenosha officials asked for it. The state later accepted additional federal assistance from the FBI and the U.S. Marshals, but declined help from the Department of Homeland Security.
So, you know, you said that essentially Trump has been repeating the kind of message that he's had for a while, since these protests really began with the death of George Floyd. How does this event fit in with Trump's messaging about the unrest in recent days?
So the appearance in Kenosha comes on the heels of the president making some other divisive comments. He said that the police officer who shot Jacob Blake in the back was like a golfer who choked on an easy putt. At the roundtable, he also expressed a lot of sympathy for police officers being in a high-stress job, trying in a way to explain bad decisions that police officers sometimes make. Here's Trump talking about that.
Well, I think people are calling for structural change, and then you could take the people of Kenosha that aren't here and that you won't see and that aren't protesting, but they want change also. They want to see law and order. That's the change they want. They want law and order. They want the police to be police. They want the police to do what they do better than anybody else in the world, and that's what they want too. You don't see them marching and you don't see them on the streets, but what they want is they want great police force. They want people that are going to keep them safe.
In the days leading up to the visit, Mr. Trump also levied support for the 17-year-old charged with killing two protesters. At a Monday press briefing, he said cell phone tapes show the shooter was acting in self-defense. That individual has been charged with two counts of homicide, one intentional and one reckless. So the Kenosha District Attorney obviously disagrees that it was self-defense, and that issue will play out in the courts.
Yeah, as you mentioned, of course, that's been debated a lot, and there's a lot of different cell phone videos of that. Did the president address the demands of racial justice protesters, the reason for all of this?
Trump didn't really talk about racial justice in his remarks. At the end of the roundtable, he was asked whether the shooting of Blake in the back seven times and other incidents that preceded it convinces him that there's a need for structural change. This is what Trump said.
We have to condemn the dangerous anti-police rhetoric. It's getting more and more. It's very unfair. You have some bad apples, we all know that, and those will be taken care of through the system, and nobody's going to be easy on them either. And you have people that choke. They're under tremendous, I said it yesterday, I said it last night, they're under tremendous pressure, and they may be there for 15 years and have a spotless record, and all of a sudden they're faced with a decision. They have a quarter of a second to make a decision. And if they make a wrong decision, one way or the other, they're either dead or they're in big trouble. And people have to understand that. They choke sometimes.
He says these people are protesters too, but they don't walk up and down the street.
So really, he pivoted away from racial justice and police brutality completely, and then tried to shift the conversation into his support for law enforcement?
Yes.
So the unrest in Kenosha started after the shooting of Jacob Blake, of course. Was anyone from the Blake family at the roundtable?
No, they weren't. On Monday, Trump said he wasn't planning on meeting with the Blake family because that would include the family's attorney, and the matter is still under investigation. Blake's mother's pastor, James Ward, and his wife were at the roundtable. Sharon Ward said during the conversation that it's important to have Black people at the table to help solve the problem, the racial justice problem. And it did look like James Ward was the only Black person at the roundtable. Sharon Ward said, though, that she thinks this whole situation is a good opportunity to solve the problem in the nation.
So what did Trump say with regard to the damaged businesses in Kenosha's downtown? Because it seems like that was one of the main reasons that he actually came to the city.
It was, and he definitely praised and offered support to the business people of Kenosha whose property was damaged. He announced extra funding as part of the effort to help Kenosha. He announced $1 million to Kenosha for law enforcement, $4 million to help small businesses, and $42 million for law enforcement statewide, including money for prosecutors. So while he is allotting money for small businesses and to rebuild in Kenosha, a lot of it is going towards law enforcement.
Okay, so it seems like most of it would go to law enforcement. What did people on the panel think of President Trump's message in general?
It was a very receptive audience in the room. Reince Priebus, Trump's former chief of staff, was there. Senator Johnson and Congressman Stile profusely thanked President Trump, crediting him with swift action. Stile, in particular, his congressional district includes Kenosha. And he was apparently receiving a lot of calls from people across the political spectrum asking about public safety when this was breaking out. So it seems that Stile called Trump and asked for federal assistance, and that's how they kind of got the ball rolling. The sheriff and the police chief thanked President Trump for sending resources. Police Chief Beth said, "Police scrutiny is a good thing, but riots aren't police scrutiny."
Yeah. Well, and of course, as you mentioned earlier in the conversation, Trump has taken credit for sending the National Guard, but Governor Tony Evers had sent them before that. With that in mind, actually, Governor Tony Evers and Kenosha Mayor John Antaramian asked the president not to come to the area because of concerns that he may increase the tension in Kenosha. And his visit was met with hundreds of protesters. Can you tell us about what that scene looked like?
As the president's motorcade drove through the city, one of our reporters noted dueling chants of Black Lives Matter and then also All Lives Matter from different groups. Roughly around the time the president was in town, there were two protests, one organized by the Blake family at the site where the shooting occurred, and another was based around organizations from Chicago. There was a third protest slated for the Civic Center Park later in the day. The gathering for the Blake family was at the house where Blake was shot. It wasn't a traditional rally with chanting and marching. It was more like a block party in the heart of the city where the shooting happened. People would speak, take the mic. There were bounce houses for kids, tables set up, people passing out bottled water and registering people to vote. People were encouraged to go up to people that they didn't know and ask them how they were doing and get to know them. But there were some serious conversations that were happening and speeches. Here's Jacob Blake's uncle, Justin Blake.
Yeah, we're asking people not to be violent, not to destroy our community. But in the same breath, we're asking to stand with the Blake family. Come on over here. We're not mad at you. We understand you're angry and upset. And we could see why you would want to burn some down, but we're asking you not to. That fist that you put up in anger, we're asking to raise up high in unity and come on board with the Blakes. We're going to make some big changes that affect all the little Jakes around this nation.
Absolutely.
So their parents can let their children go outside the door, play in the yard, go down the street, drive the vehicle, and not have to worry about police officers that might do them in, that might disallow them from getting back to their families or shoot them in the back 7 times.
Besides Justin Blake, U.S. Congresswoman Gwen Moore spoke, and civil rights activist Reverend Jesse Jackson paid a visit. He said there's been a pattern of police killing and that they demand equal protection under the law.
I guess we'll just need to keep watching this story as it continues to unfold here in Wisconsin. Mayan Silver is a WUWM reporter who has been working tirelessly the last week covering the events in Kenosha. Mayan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joy.
Coming up, we'll hear a former Kenosha crime reporter talk about the systemic issues contributing to tensions between law enforcement and the community. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues now on WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Kenosha has been in the national spotlight for less than ideal reasons. After Jacob Blake was shot 7 times in the back by a police officer, Kenosha became the nation's next rallying location in a summer of protests for racial justice. Denise Lockwood used to be a crime reporter in Kenosha, and she knew the area where the shooting happened right away because she'd been to it many times before. She wrote an opinion piece for CNN talking about her experience covering crime and violence in Kenosha. In the article, Lockwood writes about how the criminal justice system has contributed to systemic problems in the area. Lockwood is the owner of the Racine County Eye, an online news publication. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel about her perspective of what's going on in the Kenosha area after living and working there for years.
What was your reaction when you found out about the shooting of Jacob Blake?
One of the first things that I noticed was where it happened. So Wilson Heights is the neighborhood that this happened. And this is where a lot of affordable housing is. And I was there several times a week covering a lot of crime. So one of the things that I use when I am looking at what stories I'm going to cover is do I have institutional knowledge that would be helpful? So because I'm a one-person show, that's what I was like, okay, we're going to do this today. So that's really what I came forward first, because it's such a volatile area, but it's got a lot of similarities between the city of Racine and Milwaukee. That's one of the things that really struck me.
from your experience living in and reporting in the Kenosha area, have there been racial tensions in Kenosha prior to the shooting of Blake and the protests that followed?
So Kenosha hasn't had as much of an issue. And if it did, I probably am not like the best person to ask because I haven't covered it for so long. But when I was there from 2007 to 2008, and then from 2010, oh no, I was there, yeah, in 2013. So I've kind of had this smattering of experiences there. Has there been racial tensions? Yes. Has it been to the extent that it's in the Racine and Milwaukee area? Milwaukee and Racine, they're kind of cut out of all of the same cloth because of the policies that they all share and the infrastructure around the criminal justice system and a lot of the mental health issues. So I've covered those two things for 20 years. And that's one of the reasons why I wrote that piece, because quite frankly, I feel like I'm writing the same story over and over again.
And what is your take on the protests that have been happening in Kenosha?
So the protests, there's the protests and then there's the rioting. So you've kind of got these two different camps. And I've seen this quite a bit, because even when there were protests going on in the city of Racine, there was a lot of people that were part of the community that were really upset. So there's actually, in my opinion, there's two storylines that are going on. There's trying to understand what happened to Jacob Blake. And then there's also this undercurrent of, we're really tired of how people who are Black are treated. So those are two very different things, but they're also merged at the same time. And so depending on, you know, that person's experience of that, it's been an ongoing issue. And so I wasn't surprised about what had happened, but I was really surprised at how violent it got. And a lot of that had to do with a lot of the people coming in from all over the United States. That's one of the things that I noticed was a significant change, because we've had in Racine, we've had several protests, and that same type of thing happened in Racine quite a bit with the burning down of the cop house, but those were people that didn't live here. So those are some of the things that I've noticed. And then there's how people are taking in the impact on the businesses is really shocking, and the destructiveness. But on the other hand, you also have this almost emerging dialogue that is trying very hard to emerge and has always struggled for decades, right? So the idea of officer-involved shootings, the what's called the officer-directed patrols, the employment rate, and then the lack of mental health, and you've got all of these layers of things all converging at the same time, and the dialogue has been very stagnant for so long.
Does it feel like there is a change in that pace of dialogue now, or does it mirror other times when you've seen these issues be brought up in the community?
So one of the things that I have noticed is that there's a movement around a couple of different elements of that storyline. Whether you're looking at like groups like ex-prisoners organizing, whether you're looking at how we are dealing with social issues around mental health. But the problem is that the infrastructure hasn't responded. People may be responding to it, but the infrastructure and the policies around those has been very stagnant.
In the piece you wrote for CNN, you talk about systemic issues in the area that led to this moment and added to maybe tensions and the protests. Can you explain what you mean and how your reporting informed you on some of this?
So When I was covering crime for the Kenosha News, one of the things that I had done, I was going to the same neighborhoods over and over and over. So, you know, there were safety issues. And one of the things that was really striking, so back in 2010, I had done a ride along with the gang unit. And this was after several very violent crimes that happened in that area. So I don't want to project that that's what happened with Jacob Blake, okay? Because we don't have the missing pieces. We have the end of the story. We don't have the beginning, the middle, and the end cohesively in one narrative. So I want to be really careful about that piece, that there's a lot we don't know. But one of the things that is happening is you've got a lot of issues around domestic violence and mental health issues and employment. And also with like mental health is such a huge issue. So here's an example of what that looks like. So in Kenosha County, they have no mental health hospital at all. Like if you were in crisis, you would not have a hospital to go to. And Racine used to, back in 2013, used to have a 52 adult patient bed unit, and now it's down to 16. Milwaukee County Mental Health Complex had, 10 years ago when I wrote for the Milwaukee Magazine, they had 100 beds, and they had 12,000 people coming into crisis to their doorstep every year. Now they're down to like 38. So all of that is backing up into the police, and the mental health is now administered more at the county level, but it's at the jail and it's not kept up to pace. So you've got all of these other issues that are involved with, it's not just that one incident, it's everything. And that's the narrative that a lot of the protesters are saying. Look, we want to understand what's going on with Jacob Blake, but we also need to address the root cause of what caused that, right?
You said you found yourself going back to the same neighborhoods as a crime reporter when you were working in Kenosha. Do you think that you can speak to the exhaustion, not only that you felt, but then that might be felt in those communities that are continuously having these issues?
Yeah, absolutely. So now in Kenosha County, and that's one of the reasons why I started doing these bigger pieces, because honestly, it is soul sucking stuff to go to murder, to crime, to murder, to stabbing, to, you know, domestic violence. It just takes so much out of you. And you're like, well, why is this happening? And I would talk to my police officers and they're like, well, we have no mental health hospital. Why don't you do a ride along with that, Denise? Okay, let's do that. So that's what I started doing, a 5-part series on mental health. And I started doing, you know, looking at how are these systems being able to respond. And the infrastructure just isn't there and hasn't been for decades. And that's why people are so tired. When I would post stories about a police-involved shooting, oftentimes what would happen is I would hear, get a job, take care of your kids, get off of welfare, you know, stop being the lazy people. And this was mirrored on so many levels. And when you look at the data, okay, when you look at the employment rate being 18% for people of color versus 3% or 4% for people who are white, you got to go ask why. And then you look at the education piece. So this is all very clear.
Speaking more generally, what is important to understand about this moment in Wisconsin?
This is a flashpoint. It's a very emotional, traumatic thing on many different levels. Whether you're looking at the angle of what happened with Jacob or what happened to those business owners who lost their businesses and have to struggle to rebuild, whether you're looking at it from a gun rights issue of who can open carry, who can, you know, there's just so many different levels. What is rioting? What are the responsibility of the rioters as far as like all of that is a heavy, heavy emotional toll, you know? So at the end of the day, those are the things that when I'm looking at this storyline that have to be built into the comprehensive story. And one of the struggles that I have as a journalist is if you're getting things so rapid fire at you that it's like, how do you make meaning out of that? So at first, everyone thought, oh, well, Jacob Blake was murdered. He wasn't murdered, but he was also shot in the back 7 times. And I think we lose sight and lose a lot of ourselves from the political lens that is being forced onto this. That's what's feeling different. It's hard to watch. Really hard.
What are the solutions being discussed?
So there's this policy around, and it's almost like an unwritten policy. And the narrative of this is reflective of the communities, right? Of the lock them up forever and ever and ever and throw away the key. My job is to say, wait, okay, so let's look at what that actually means. So we spend as taxpayers in Wisconsin, $1.3 billion on that entire prison system. And it's not just the prisons, it's also all of those people in extended supervision and probation. And that's a number, and in jail, that's 105,000 people. That's a lot of people. So the question is, how much does that cost us? Not only from a taxpayer standpoint, but also in unraveling the mental and physical toll that that takes. So there's an underground economy that has to exist for people to be okay. If you're a felon who's getting out of prison with $100,000 in fines and fees, and you get a job, and that's a job that's $10 an hour, and after you're paying your fines and fees, it's really a $5 an hour job, where do you live? And so when we talk about solutions to that, it's really disrupting those problems as we're coming in. So what if you want people to have a job, if that's the goal, how do you accomplish that? And I think one of the bright spots in how we are accomplishing that, but needs to be expanded, is the Department of Vocational Rehabilitation group, because quite frankly, when you come out of prison, you have the ability to have some support system, but there's a waiting list. And when you go into prison, and if you've been have been ordered to do programming, there's a waiting list. And when you're trying to get, you see where I'm going with this? There's always a waiting list. Why is that? Because we haven't funded this stuff. So we have to really look at how we have better conversations around this stuff, right? Because if we don't start having better conversations, you know, Wisconsin is facing a really big problem called a workforce shortage. So I think the table has definitely been set. And I think there's some really creative things that are going on, especially in manufacturing and relationships between like the Department of Corrections, things along that line. So I see a lot of good stuff happening, but it's just not enough. And people are suffering because of it.
Denise Lockwood was a crime reporter in Kenosha for several years and now owns the Racine County Eye, an online news publication. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becca Schimmel. We'll take a short break, then get some tips on how to talk to your kids about racism. Lake Effect will return in just a moment on WUWM. Lake Effect continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The recent protests in Kenosha and around the country against police brutality have put the issue of systemic racism on full display. For many kids, these demonstrations have raised a lot of new questions about race and racism. These can be difficult topics to discuss. But child and family therapist Lakeisha Russell says it's helpful to have these conversations with young children. Research shows that kids can pick up these racial biases as early as 4 years old. Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski spoke with Russell to learn more about talking to kids about race, racism, and the current protests.
Parents raise kids with phrases like everyone is equal or be colorblind, but this is without thinking about tools kids don't necessarily have to navigate racism, especially later in life. So with recent events and protests against police brutality and systemic racism, how can parents address their own biases and unconscious behaviors that we don't necessarily realize kids are picking up on?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think just for parents to do some of that introspection, so some of that self-questioning work, and, you know, maybe it's them taking that time out to write down, okay, how am I around this certain group of people? You know, if I'm in these spaces with them in the workplace or educational systems, like, how do I interact with them? How do I connect with them? Have I ever said anything that might have been triggering for them or leading them to think, could I be a little racist?
And do you think it's important for parents to recognize, oh, I haven't had any of these kind of conversations with my kids yet? You know, should it be up to the parents to bring this up and not necessarily waiting for your kid to ask about what's happening on the news?
Yeah, because you want to open up that dialogue with your child. And, you know, sometimes if we wait for our kids to come to us with things, you know, it might be years down the line or it might not happen at all. And so I would encourage parents to go ahead and set that groundwork, because what we know to be true is, like, by age 4, kids are already picking up those racial biases. And so the younger we start, the better. So I encourage parents to have those conversations as early as they possibly can.
So you mentioned by age 4, these behaviors can be picked up. So let's kind of divide up, because kids can range, obviously, in ages. So let's divide things: toddlers, elementary age school kids, and teenagers. So within these three categories, what do you think is the best way to approach these conversations for these age groups? And we can start with toddlers.
Yeah, so with toddlers, what we know is they love stories, right? Or cartoons, shows, things like that. And so I would encourage parents to tap into some of those resources, whether it be books or maybe it's shows that highlights other characters of other ethnicities in a positive light. And, you know, just asking your child, so what do you think about seeing that? Like, do they seem to be treated fairly if it was like a situation involving kids of color in a certain segment? And so just using those kind of tools, whether it's books or if it's TV shows, just of other ethnicities and cultures that are displayed in the positive light. Because again, you want to reinforce that just because you don't look like me doesn't mean that I'm bad.
Right. When it comes to elementary age school kids, what is this age range and what do you recommend for a little more deeper conversations compared to what we're talking about with toddlers?
Right. And so typically for elementary age kids, it's usually like 6 years old to like 12 or 11 years old. And I would recommend, you know, just having kind of direct conversations with them in the sense of, what have you been hearing in the news as of late about what's going on? How does that make you feel? How do you think we can help? So just asking more developed questions than you would the toddler age. But again, it's age appropriate. It's not so in your face as if you were talking to your teenager about it.
Right. So let's get to teenagers, because with teenagers, is what we're also seeing is obviously kids also want to take part in activism and fight for change. So when it comes to engaging with our teens and yourself as a Black mother, let's talk about some of the differences that non-POC parents would have with their teenagers versus teenagers that come from families that are Black or people of color.
Yeah. And so, you know, you made a good point that I see it now, especially like on my social media. What we see in the news is that teenagers really want to take part in what's going on and be that change. And I would just encourage parents to process that with them, you know, and not be afraid to do that with them. Because again, I feel like this generation will be the change that we've been waiting for, that will help us see these changes and make headway with things changing. And so I would just encourage parents of teenagers just to process that with them and, you know, finding different ways that they can, because sometimes, you know, you don't always need to be at the forefront in terms of like the protesting. Maybe it's other ways that you can like spread the word and just get other people to start changing. Maybe it's something you do on social media where you get your friends together, you have these conversations live where other people are able to tap into them. Or maybe it's starting in your home, you know, maybe it's having those conversations with your parents to help change just how they're thinking about things.
And on the note of protests and marching, then middle school to teenagers knowing what that means, but when it's little children who are being tugged along in the wagon with their parents or in the stroller, how do parents explain what is happening when they decide to bring their kids to a march?
Yeah, I think just having that direct conversation, talking about the inequality with this group of people and that we want to come together and support them so things are equal and fair. And then I always like to add in some kind of like real time moment for kids to really understand, and maybe asking your little kid, has there ever been a time that you can remember where you thought something wasn't fair with you? And then weave it in to help them better understand why we are doing what we're doing and why we're coming together to support this group of people.
So how can parents make a space for their kids to demonstrate that this is a safe place to freely share what kids are thinking about, even if they don't fully understand what's happening? You know, because parents can decide to want to jump on a topic or control something, sometimes shut it down. And if their kids are reticent to have those conversations, especially in this moment, how can parents really open up a safe space?
Yeah. And I think it's just by parents actively listening to what your child is sharing with you, and just understanding as a parent, like we want to be able to like have all the answers right then and there and be able to create that dialogue. But it's okay just to listen, you know, and absorb everything that they're saying and then come back to things if you're not really sure on how to respond, but just provide that safe space of non-judgment and just actively listening to what your child is sharing with you.
And obviously, conversations about race and racism are certainly not a one-time only conversation. So how can parents best approach and convey to their kids that this is a conversation to be encouraged to engage with many times, not just with their family, but with their friends? One day when kids go back to school post-COVID, what it means to think about things in their lives, you know, post-quarantine living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think just for parents, bringing that part up that, you know, I don't want you to think that this is the end all be all to this conversation, but I'm here for answers. I'm here if you just want to share and you just want me to listen. And then maybe, you know, challenging them, like, how do you think you'll have these conversations with your friends if it comes up, or other family members?
What would you say to parents who may have that first reaction of, no, my kid's too little to talk about this, I'm not going to go down this road right now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would encourage parents, you know, to, if we can dismantle that thinking, because at the end of the day, kids pick up on how we respond and react to situations. And, you know, whether we are doing it consciously or unconsciously, they've already picked up racial biases and standards. And so just for parents to know that our kids are watching how we're interacting with people, every kind of people. And so just to keep that at the forefront, and that it's not a conversation that you have to be afraid of having, because I think we come from that lens of, as parents, we got to know what to say, when to say it, how to say it. But for parents to give themselves that grace to understand, like, we are still learning how to talk about race as adults, even to this day. So it's okay if you don't have all those answers with your kids, but just knowing that the earlier, the better with the conversation is best.
So Black parents are having very different conversations than white parents with their kids around the topic, especially of police brutality, for the teenagers, for the older kids that, and even younger ones that are seeing protests across the country and militarized police. You know, these are very strong images that kids can pick up on. You know, for example, most white children are told the police are safe. You go to them if you're in trouble, while Black children are told a very different reality, such as this is what you need to do if you're pulled over or if you encounter. So how can we help kids empathize with this and also model anti-racism behaviors?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think just again, going back, sharing those stories, those historical stories of just the injustices and the inequalities of Black people and white people, you know, if we can just be candid and real and honest about it. And, you know, and not in a way that is scaring kids, because I'm not for scaring kids into like empathizing with others, but, you know, giving them real descriptions or real examples of, you know, your classmate who looks different than you has to go and have different stories told to them about who we deem to be safe in the community. And so how do you think that makes them feel? Because I feel like once we can tackle and tap into the lens of how does it make the other person feel, I feel like that better helps us to empathize and have compassion with others, because again, it's just you going into their shoes. So maybe it's the parent just having that conversation. Like, if that was you, how do you think you would feel? You know, and the kid might be like, I might be sad, I might be frustrated, you know, give you all these emotion words, and then go into that deeper dive on the importance of equality and justice.
When it comes to the protests, obviously a lot of this was sparked because of the death of George Floyd by Minneapolis police officers and the video, the visceral video that was taken, the 8 minutes, 49 seconds of video. And even if kids see just a snippet of this, whether it's played briefly on the local news or all the videos that have come before this that have been published publicly, depending on the kid's age, and obviously it's a visceral reaction for adults, and mean something different to Black adults, Black kids. How do you talk to kids about seeing those kinds of images? And also maybe just asking, like, did they see it? Because maybe kids saw it, but they're not going to talk about it, but it's something that's etched into their brain.
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think it just goes with, again, having that space for your child to share with you. But what I always encourage parents, because if you've seen the video and you're triggered by it, get yourself regulated first before having this conversation with your child. Because again, kids feed off of our emotions, our energy, our actions. And so for the parent themselves is to get themselves self-regulated first and then have that conversation. And you know, and I think it's just asking them, especially if they're teenagers, right? Like, hey, did you happen to see the video? And you know, allow that to be that opportunity for your child to say yes or no. And you know, for our younger kids, if they happen to be in the room and the news is going on and they happen to see that, I encourage parents to turn it off right then and there and help them process that, you know, because they might be confused and they might be like, oh, well, if they're supposed to help us, why did they do this? Or, you know, what have you, whatever it might be. And so just opening that dialogue and again, not being afraid to seek professional help, because then too, you know, if your child is constantly worried about their own safety, trouble sleeping, not eating, you know, then it might be time to tap into a therapist to help them process that trauma that they experienced from watching that.
Right, because kids can be resilient and pick up on a lot, but do you think it's also time that the mental health component of our children should be thought of earlier to engage that way?
Definitely, definitely. I'm a firm believer that you don't need to have a mental health illness in order to participate in therapy. Therapy is that tool to help you through those situations when life comes. And so I'm all for parents like having kids in therapy just to develop some of those coping skills they need. And then definitely after like some kind of traumatic event as well.
So as a parent, what other kinds of conversations are Black parents having that you wish other parents, non-Black parents, would know about that go beyond the current highlight of police brutality.
Yeah. And I have so many stories, but one personal story for me, just as a Black mom with a Black son, you know, just when COVID started, you know, everybody like had the mask and things like that. And I remember me and my son were going to the grocery store and I had on my mask, but he ended up having a bandana. And, you know, we're like in the store, just pushing the cart and things. And I was like, oh, I forgot to get this down this aisle. And I was like, wait right here by the cart. Do not move. Stay right here in the vicinity of other people. Because instinctually, what I thought about, you're a Black boy wearing a bandana around your face. And if I'm gonna be honest, you'll be first profiled that you are doing something illegal when you really are not. You're just trying to keep yourself safe because you forgot to bring your mask. And so for me, like, I would like for parents to know that, like, for us as Black parents, we often have to think twice as hard in terms of our kids' safety. And, you know, along those lines, I feel like it comes with that adultification of our Black and brown boys and girls too in our society, which I think often entails that police brutality. And I say that, and again, that could be like for a whole nother segment or whatnot, but you know, my son is a bigger 12-year-old, but again, he's still a boy, he's not a man, but yet society portrays our Black and brown kids as older than what they are.
And so how do you think parents can also advocate for their kids when it comes to the school setting? When things are back, quote, to normal, hopefully the classroom will also be a place where more of these discussions are had.
Yeah. And I encourage parents, show up, pull up, you know, interact with the teacher, stay consistent, stay connected, be engulfed and immersed. And I'm not saying, you know, parents, because parents are probably like, Lakeisha, you know, I got to work and things like that. But I'm a firm believer, you know, whether you got to take a few hours off of work just to show up and be present randomly, and then stay consistent with, in terms of like parent-teacher conferences, school events, like show your face and be immersed in that. Because then too, I think that allows the teachers and the school to know that, okay, this parent is willing and able to connect with us and engage with us. So I encourage parents to show up.
And are you hopeful that these different spaces that kids occupy will be changing now that these conversations are being had, not just in people's homes, but on state levels, federal levels, policies are being enacted? So what do you see is the work that needs to be done when it comes to continuously engaging with children about this?
Yeah, and so I'm hopeful that things, we will start to see change, just because I feel like with the protests and people speaking up and advocating, that we are starting to see more of a turn, you know, whether it's in the educational system and like you said, on the state and local levels in government. And even I would say with like these Fortune 500 companies, right? Because now they're tapping into us Black people to come and bring and explain and help them process things that's going on. And so I want to believe that there will be some kind of change and some hope for that. But I think what needs to happen though is having more of us in those conversations, right? So if we're talking about diversity and inclusion, we should see people that are the minorities in those conversations. If I can be really, you know, we can just be honest about that. You know, and then having those people, Black and brown folks, show up in those spaces and just helping people to process the emotions of what's going on. And then I think too, for white people to also be willing to learn, you know, whether it's you reading books, it's so many books that talks about racism and things like that within different sectors, you know, systemic racism within education, within government systems. So reading that literature and really applying those tools and techniques, because it's one thing to get these trainings, to be educated and have these consultants come in. But if you aren't willing to actually do that work to change those systems, then all this will be for nothing.
And what would you say to parents now to encourage self-education, but also the education of their kids, no matter what age and what kind of household they have?
Yeah, I would tell parents to continue to be open-minded, you know, and if you need help, it's okay to ask professionals or maybe ask trusted friends or family members that can help bridge this dialogue. And then I'm a firm believer in reading, you know, because again, it's so much literature out there about racism, how to talk to kids, you know, how to make change within systems of systemic racism. And so I would just encourage parents to tap into every possible resource.
Well, Lakeisha Russell, you are certainly one of those resources, and I thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today about this very important topic.
Thank you for having me.
Lakeisha Russell is a child and family therapist at the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Audrey Nowakowski in June, and you can listen to their full conversation at WUWM.com. And that is today's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can join us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. It's 11 o'clock, and stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.